Hello and welcome to the People and Culture Podcast, a program dedicated to exploring topical and emerging issues impacting on the world of work. I'm your host, James Judge. Joining me today from Brisbane, Queensland, via the phone on the People and Culture Podcast is Dr. Tim Baker. Tim is the author of 7 books and works across many areas, including consulting, coaching, keynote speaking, lecturing, as a master trainer, and as an organisational psychologist. He's worked around the world with a range of public and private sector organisations, and I'm delighted to be talking to him about his experiences, thoughts, and insights. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, James. Great to be here.
So, Tim, I thought we'd start with your current business, Winners at Work. How did that get started, and how has it evolved?
Well, it started 18 years ago, and the name Winners at Work came to me in the shower, like all good ideas. I was trying to struggle to think of a name for the business that sort of encapsulated what I did, and I guess it is about that. It is about trying to create more productive people at work, whether they be managers or employees. I predominantly work with leaders in organisations, and yeah, so that's how it all started, and I'm proud to say I've been staying in the same business for 18 years, and there's a lot of people that get into consulting for a couple of years and sort of see it as a bit of a transition between jobs. I see it as a total career, and I've thoroughly enjoyed every moment of it, actually, and I intend to continue.
I was going to ask about that, how the business, has the business changed at all in the 18 years since you started it? Given the range of things you do, have you found that over time, you know, different economic conditions or different client needs, you've had to move between those different services you offer, or has it been consistent?
It has changed. For example, when I started out, it wouldn't be unusual to do a 2-day, you know, back-to-back workshop somewhere about leadership. These days, it's very rare. Obviously, people now can do things online, and I think that whole face-to-face is reducing in size. So people now, if they do face-to-face, and I still do a fair bit, it's more likely to be short, sharp sessions over, you know, very much, you know, 2 hours, maybe half a day. Interesting, though, in Asia, they're still very much caught up with the 2-day or even 3 days approach. And I think the argument there is, you know, it's hard enough to get people offline or out of the workplace, so we might as well keep everyone together at the same time. So that has changed. There's a lot more coaching going on. I'm doing a lot more executive coaching than I once was. And I think initially coaching was about, you know, this is the last resort. If you don't, if you can't respond to this coach, we're going to show you the door. You'll walk the plank. So I think, and now, of course, it's almost like a badge of honour. People say, oh, you know, I've got an executive coach and we're working on this or that. So that's increased significantly. But the market is a lot more discernible, how they spend their training and development, or should I say learning and development dollars. They want value for money, and they expect you to be able to demonstrate or quantify some value for money. So there's a few of the changes.
Yeah, right. So that's interesting. That remedial coaching, I think, was where a lot of it started, didn't it?
That's right.
Many years ago. And what about coaching versus mentoring? Have you seen any changes or differences there over the past 20 years?
I still think organisations are doing this very poorly. I, you know, anyone that's had a good mentor, and I've had a couple, you know, I wouldn't say that we sat down and said, "Will you mentor me?" It just sort of happened, as it often does. But I think what happens is a lot of organisations try and formalise it too much. And, you know, they say, well, you know, James, you're going to be mentored by Tim and so-and-so will do this and you will have 6 sessions and you'll report back. And it doesn't work like that. But on the other hand, if you don't have some structure around it, it's kind of likely not to happen. And so mentoring, of course, is more of giving advice, whereas coaching is more a sounding board and, you know, when I'm coaching, it's more about getting people to look and think differently about what they're doing and challenging them that way. I suppose mentoring is in a way too, but it's more based on experience and giving people feedback and that sort of thing. But I just think it's one of the still one of the large untapped areas in both the public and private sector.
Yes. Mentoring, if it's done completely in an unstructured way on an organisational level, can be difficult to measure outcomes. But as you and without structure, things can go south pretty quickly after the fourth cup of coffee. But it's often it's not as structured as formal coaching arrangements. I wanted to talk about some of your clients because you have worked around the world and we've already touched upon the difference between public and private clients. Who do you think's been the most challenging client you've ever had to deal with?
Oh, boy, there's been a few, I guess. None comes to mind. The challenging clients, I can actually recall one, and now that you mention it, and that was a client that was using 360-degree feedback basically to sack people. 360 feedback, I'm a strong believer in it, but it's more of a developmental tool than an appraisal approach. You know, it's about, you know, holding a mirror up to people and letting them have a look inside. Yeah. And I do recall, actually, I gave this feedback on the CEO, and it wasn't terribly bad at all, actually, the feedback, and he was going quite well. But I got a call from the chairman of the board, who, when he rang me, it was interesting. He said, "Look, I'm ringing you. I've got you on speakerphone. I'm in the car, and I have the deputy chairman in the car with me." And I said, "Okay, what do you want to talk
next?
About?" Yeah, exactly. I thought, "Okay, we can't get out of here." He said, "Well, how would you rate the report? Because I stated very clearly that this was something between myself and the CEO. Anyway, I said, "Oh, look, it's not too bad." And he said, "How would you rate it out of 10? And I said, "If I was forced to put a rating on it, which I wasn't, but I'd give it about a 7. And he, you know, he was trying to twist it around to saying, "Well, what were the problems?" And you know, in other words, what it was done, it was an exercise in getting an outside person to give a negative bit of feedback about someone that clearly this person wanted to get rid of. And, you know, I just wasn't going to wear that. I've had a couple of those in my time, but, you know, I'm a little bit wiser about those things now. But so people using consultants for those sorts of ends does happen. It's not as common, but it will happen at times. And I remember doing a workshop in Saudi Arabia and, you know, I'd indicated, you know, this was my sort of daily rate or whatever it was that I was going. And when I arrived there, you know, I was expecting like 20 in the room. And well, they were hanging from the rafters. We had about 75 people in the room because the thinking was, you know, the HR manager was thinking, I guess, well, we've paid this guy, you know, let's just stuff them all into the room as if that's going to actually make a big difference. And in terms of, you know, we'll expose everyone to this. Well, of course, that was a useless exercise because people couldn't, people didn't want to communicate, but, you know, we couldn't have small group discussions and all the rest of it. And I couldn't engage with the group. So I found that really quite interesting.
What about, we've talked about some of the challenges and often it seems from the examples you've used, it's around being hired to do something that you didn't sign on for. What about some of the more rewarding assignments? You look back think of some great times or some great events or some great clients over those 20 years?
Oh, they're numerous. And look, the thing that gives you the buzz in what I do is that I don't have to get involved, as you can imagine, in the organisational politics. I can just get on my horse and ride off into the sunset after I've done my job. I'm still, though, very interested, obviously, in whether or not there's been any real behavioural change, because obviously, you know, it's what gives me the buzz at least. And to hear feedback that, for example, there's one organisation that I won't mention their name. It probably wouldn't be a good idea, but they, let's put it this way, they're a large airline. They're not Australian-based too, I might say, but one of the issues there is that they wanted to get conversations occurring, you know, getting more. They wanted to move away from the performance review and move towards, you know, more of a conversation type approach, which, of course, everyone's attempting to do now, or a lot of people are. And what was really, really rewarding is that I got an opportunity. So we, you know, we ran some workshops and we did some coaching and we did all the things that we needed to do and explained how the five conversations framework worked, let people do that. And I remember in one workshop, one of the senior managers said to me, and this is why I walked away wondering how this would go. He said to me, and of course there was lots of people in there with him, and he said, "This seems a bit artificial, doesn't it?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I don't feel comfortable reading off these questions." And everyone was sort of shuffling in their chair because obviously it wasn't about reading off questions. It was really just as a guide. We just want you to talk. We just want you to connect and engage with people. And of course, I couldn't say that publicly. And I said, "What do you mean?" And, you know, and but my point was that I walked away quite negative about, I think this isn't going to work. But I came back 2 months later and did a number of group coaching, which is another big thing that's happening now, where we get three or four people in a room and they learn from each other and bounce ideas off each other, which is a wonderful way of learning. Anyway, I did this across the organisation. It's a fairly large, being an airline, a fairly large organisation. And I did a few of these and I heard some unbelievably wonderful stories of connection and insight and so forth. And yeah, that was one that just comes to mind. And you know, and you know that you've made a difference just by implementing that. And that's really what it's all about. And obviously now I've got to crack the whip and make sure that that's sustainable. But from the feedback that I was getting, it definitely would be. And there was a lot of skepticism initially. So that's often the cycle that we go through: denial and then skepticism and then, you know, a little bit of muddling around and then ultimately some commitment when it goes really well, that is, and there is commitment in this case.
You mentioned there a model that you use, and I did want to turn to the books that you'd written. I was going to focus on the most recent book, which I think you published this year, Performance Management for Agile Organisations, Overthrowing the 8 Management Myths Holding Business Back. The title begs the question, what are the 8 management myths holding business back?
Well, all of these myths have come from the sort of Taylorist scientific management at the turn of the last century when Frederick Taylor, who was an engineer, came in and he was asked by Henry Ford to, how do we increase productivity? And so he basically created a, you know, an assembly line with a one-way approach, so everyone did things in a certain way. And what, by the way, Frederick Taylor, I think, is the most influential management consultant of all time. People talk about Drucker and a few others, but there's no question in terms of influence, Frederick Taylor had unbelievable influence, so much so, in fact, that many organisations are now still working on his ideas. So the myths in the book are really around us still using Taylorism, you know, in this 21st century when things aren't any longer an assembly line. So, for example, there is a myth that people understand their organisational role better with a job description. Well, they don't. They understand a small patch of work in the organisation that they're supposed to do. But in fact, it actually mitigates against them understanding the organisation, because, I mean, they're just concerned about their little patch because they know their KPIs are around that. They know their, so it's a myth to say that job descriptions actually increase performance. They don't. In fact, if anything, they decrease performance, in my view. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't have a work document. Of course we should. People must know what they're accountable for. But to suggest that we can capitalize, you know, put everything down on this piece of paper, that what people do is nonsense. In fact, that's why we have a little disclaimer at the bottom, legal disclaimer, saying any other duty deemed you know, important by the manager, you must do, which is quite ridiculous. So why have it in the first place? Because what we're trying to do is cover too much, and there's two dimensions. There's the work dimension and there's the non-job dimension. And it's the non-job dimension that's not covered in the job description. Things like having the right attitude, being solution-focused, you know, being a team player, bringing your ideas to work, being innovative and continuously improving. So that, you know, the book gets into all that sort of stuff and just really interrogates some of these myths that we've been perpetuating since Taylor, who was, of course, very successful in increasing productivity, but bearing in mind that the workplace is not Henry Ford's assembly line anymore.
I think the end of job descriptions is another one of your books too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I'm not suggesting we should never work document. The subtitle in there probably says more, and that's saying moving from a job focus to a performance focus.
Yep.
So, yeah.
A lot of thinking and writing done around that at the moment, the importance of culture fit, the importance of mindset as opposed to skill set. Thinking about the public versus the private sector, and this is a broad categorization. It's not always true. Obviously, it differs depending on which country you're in, what size of government, what level of government. Any noticeable differences for you in terms of the sorts of people and capability or people and culture challenges that leaders and managers face?
Yeah, look, I think you can learn. I think both, I work across both sectors and also in the not-for-profit. And I think all three can actually learn a significant amount from each other. And they are. There's quite a difference. I mean, the focus in the private sector is all about the end result, and you know, as long as we get the end result, it doesn't matter. So they can learn a lot from the public sector around, you know, getting process right, whether it's risk mitigation or whatever. They can learn a lot. And the public sector, I think, if I had to make a generalisation, are probably too focused on the process and not enough on the outcome. And they could learn a lot from the private sector around, let's be clear about what we're trying to do here. And I think what both of them can learn from the not-for-profit is that the not-for-profit, a lot of people will work for, you know, significantly less wages and working in the not-for-profit. And the reason is because they believe in the cause. And so the thing that both of the other sectors can learn from is the need to be very clear about the why of work. You know, of course, there's a lot of writing about the why of work. But, you know, let's be clear about what we're actually doing here. But I don't think leadership is much different. You know, the concepts are still pretty much the same. You know, they're not always practiced, of course.
Universally applicable.
No, yeah, that's right. I think so. I think people are people. I often say to people, you know, at the end of the day, you know, all an organisation is a bunch of people working towards a common cause. And I think fundamentally that's the way we've got to look at things. I think we complicate things in HR too much. That's essentially the starting point. And what that means is I work across 21 industries, right from orchestras right through to, you know, military organisations. And fundamentally, the needs and interests of people are exactly the same. Of course, they all say, "Oh, we're different," you know. But they're not really. And I'm in that wonderful position to be able to make that claim that they're not really that different.
Okay, what about next year, Tim? What have you got planned for 2018?
Well, I'm going to be doing. I've got another book coming out called "The 10 Powerful Conversations That Managers Must Have." Oh, sorry, that leaders must have, and the subtitle is, which I quite like, is "Bringing the Human Being Back to Work." And the book, the manuscript's pretty much done. It's just a matter of going through the processes of it. It's really, I guess, arguing that we're all very worried about robots taking over our jobs. And that's quite interesting that we should fear that when we've become more and more robotic as people in the workplace. So, you know, don't bring your problems to work, you know, toughen up, princess, you know, all these kinds of things. You know, I won't open a can of worms by raising this in the meeting. We don't humanise ourselves at all in the workplace. So I'm arguing that by having these 10 powerful conversations, leaders can open the door. And, you know, just for an example, one of the conversations is the encouraging conversation. Instead of just walking past someone, you know, just say thank you, or, you know, appreciate the work that you've done, or I know you can do it, I wouldn't be asking you otherwise, things like that. So that's one of the projects. But, yeah, so I'm pretty excited about that book because it's very much a – you could pick it up and turn to any of the any of the 10 conversations and implement it straight away.
It sounds very effective for managers wanting to improve their performance appraisal approach, not just a tick a box once or twice a year but on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I am still staggered by how few leaders actually understand, or managers understand, the power and importance of that. I think part of it is that busyness gets in the way, and I think they also, it's hard to measure the impact of a conversation. I guess another thing, I remember a manager saying to me the other day, I thought it was quite amusing, he said, oh, look, we don't have time for conversations. And I said, you know, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, we're too busy getting the product out the door. And I said, yeah, but surely you must talk about that. I mean, oh, yes, we have those conversations. So, of course, the implication was that he thought that anything that wasn't, you know, a work-related conversation, it was a waste of time. So, you know, I think there's a bit of that going on out there.
Yeah, it's very, very hard to unlock people's motivators and discretionary effort if you don't actually understand what's going on and what's motivating them. Tim, thank you so much for joining us here today and sharing your insights and approaches.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thanks, James. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks, Tim. Tim's website can be found at winnersatwork.com.au. You've been listening to the People and Culture Podcast with me, James Judge. If you want to make a comment or have suggestions for future shows, feel free to email me, jjudge@themandarin.com.au. Thanks for listening.